Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined by David Strapinas. How are you, David?
I'm awesome. Now, and yourself?
Good. Now, we should explain to you guys what's been going on with the VFX show. David and I and the rest of the guys are, of course, all working professionals. And in the last few weeks, we've had an enormous amount of complications, I guess, for recording due to just the fact that we've been all over the shop. I'm actually now recording this from Santa Monica, but since I spoke to you guys last, I've been in New Orleans and Japan and, oh gosh, all over the place. And David, you've been doing things, including going down to Comic-Con, is that right?
Yeah, I made my annual pilgrimage to the world of geekdom. I try to go every year if work allows, and past couple of years I haven't been able to, but seeing as Avatar was going to be shown this year, there was no possible way you could keep me away.
Well, we're going to be discussing Star Wars, the rest of them. We discussed Star Wars Episode 1 because we thought it was so significant as a single element. We're actually going to now go
episode
on...
Episode 4.
Okay, I'm sorry, beg your pardon. Episode 4, the first Star Wars that was screened, was the subject of our previous Star Wars recording. We thought rather than cover all the rest of the other five films individually, we'd lump them somewhat in together as we looked at the transition from that initial period right through to the present day and what's been happening with the sort of spin-off series, if you like. So that'll be coming up, but we'd be remiss if we didn't touch quickly on just a couple little things coming out of Comic-Con and SIDGRAPH, where I've been in New Orleans. So, David, I guess the thing is, I'm certainly busting to find out, as I'm sure many of our listeners are, Avatar, the first public show, I guess, out in the United States. There were some, I think, showing in Europe. What was the reaction from the crowd?
It was pretty good. I think, I'm obviously extremely, extremely biased towards what was shown. What was really cool for me is I'd seen all but one of the sequences finished already, but the one that I hadn't seen before was actually one of the earliest ones that I got to have some real intense creative control on, although creative control might be stretching my influence a little bit. But, you have 6,800 people viewing it all at the same time was pretty spectacular. And it was good to see Jim and John and Sigourney and Slang and Zoe all up on stage getting their due rewards. I thought I was a nerd, but when I saw people camping out for more than a day, and I mean, I'm serious, there were people who were in line for over 30 hours because there were a bunch of people in line to see Twilight. So the people who really wanted to see Avatar also had to get in line and sit through the Twilight screaming girls. But it was pretty cool. There's a, there's no way you can kind of put into words the energy that comes from a room filled with 6,800 people viewing it and in stereo. And I got to say, they did a really spectacular job with the quality of the projection that was put up in such a non-projection-friendly room. It's not a dedicated theater. So having these big screens that were really bright in HD, in stereo, great calibration. I was really impressed with the presentation. So
what was the stereo delivery method for that screening?
I believe it was Real D.
Okay. So silver screens and...
Yeah. Well, I think they were just using the kind of standard screens. So it was not absolutely ideal, but it was pretty cool. The one thing I kind of realized at Comic-Con is, there are a lot of people who are interested in a lot of things or interested in geekdom as a generality. But when you have somebody who's really, really, really into whatever it is they're passionate about, it's pretty amazing. Like, I really like the show Lost. I was not prepared for the Lost fans that were there on Saturday. Exactly how much they're in love with every little bit of that show, or people were in love with Star Wars. But the one thing I do want to comment on is the thing I love best about Comic-Con, and you see this to an extent at SIGGRAPH as well, is you have people of all races, both genders, all sexual persuasions, and no one cares. They're all, they're bound by their fanaticism for all things nerd, whether that's pop culture or anime or computer graphics or whatever. And I don't know, it was endearing to see, I think, you know, people who just in the outside world are kind of looked down upon by others as nerds and geeks and such, to just, you know, to not take that same animosity and have to segment people off and hate on each other. And I thought that was really good.
I must admit, I went to a Stones concert a while ago, and I remember at that just being struck at 1 minute. I think it was a Stones concert. It was like something like that, like a U2 Stones kind of thing. It was like all these people shared the same interest and everyone was in a good mood. Do you know what I mean? It was like a wonderful experience to have that much humanity all kind of positively moving in the same direction, as opposed to, say, a sporting event where by almost definition you have half the crowd kind of going against the other half, as it were. Hey, I wanted to discuss the stereoscopic stuff, because I had a very interesting time at some of the presentations done at SIDGRAPH this year. Again, I think they did a particularly good job at presenting the stereoscopic stuff to an audience in a theater environment that wasn't an ideal environment. In my case, there were some very, very good talks from Pixar, and one in particular on stereoscopic and not only the stereoscopic nature of the film Up and how that related to the plot, but more importantly, the stereoscopic revisiting of Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2 in the lead up to Toy Story 3, which reminded me, getting back to our subject matter, that I've actually seen tests, and I don't know if you have, of people that have done a stereoization, a stereo split derived from the original single camera master on Star Wars. Have you seen any of those?
Yeah, I have, and it's pretty awesome. I saw a reel that had multiple VFX pillar movies over the years that had been converted over to 3D, and yeah, it looks pretty darn cool. There's varying ways you can do it. You know, they did it with Nightmare Before Christmas a couple of years ago and released it. You know, you can pull the elements and do kind of a multi-plane camera 3D. But you can also do what Disney's doing with Beauty and the Beast, where they're actually, you know, projecting it onto geometry and doing sorts of tricks to give actual roundness to the forms. And I believe that's how that Star Wars stuff that's been floating around in the stereo world.
In particular impressed with the opening fight sequence of Episode 3. And I offer this as a pretty interesting pinnacle for me of the transition of where Star Wars got to. It was something I didn't actually know when I first watched the film, is that apparently Steven Spielberg actually directed that opening fight space battle sequence at the beginning of Ep 3, the last of the films that was released. And I found it brilliant when it was in mono, and it was even more interesting in stereo. And for me, that was kind of a Star Wars high point. Was that a sequence that you saw?
I saw that, and I also saw some stuff that was, going back to the trench run in Episode 4. That Steven Spielberg directed sequence, you know, Steven Spielberg had always said that he had hoped to direct one of the Star Wars himself, but, you know, it's George's baby, so he let it be. But it's just shows how much even other directors can be a fanboy of the property. But the property actually lends itself quite well to stereo space, because of the, especially in the prequels, because of the high color contrast design of the world, that works to the favor of stereo space photography. The more monochromatic something is, if it's extremely monochromatic, it works really well in stereo. If it's very high contrast in colors, it works well in stereo. If it's kind of a muddled middle range, it can kind of all bleed together. So the Star Wars aesthetic works well in stereo.
Well, let's keep discussing that third and final ep, as it were, ep 3, because I think, as I say, I wanted to sort of work our way back towards it. I'm going to say, for me, that is the end of the Star Wars films as I'm willing to consider them. I don't consider Clone Wars to be anything more than a Saturday morning cartoon that they released a film version of. I don't know if you'd agree with me on that, but I really consider the Star Wars films finishing with that third prequel.
Yeah, I would agree that those are. Although I got to say, I really enjoyed the Gendy Tartakovsky. I can never get that guy's last name right. The 2D Clone Wars, the little 5-minute snippet ones, I thought those were really quite well done, and I would have enjoyed seeing him take that into a full feature.
And by the same token, we could equally be sitting here discussing the gaming world, because the gaming world continues to this day to produce more things in the Star Wars in a world or environment. But I'm going to stop with that third film. And I guess for me, that third film was a real highlight. That opening sequence in particular, I really loved. And I was fortunate enough actually to speak to both the previous guys that had worked on it some time ago, and also hear the guys at ILM discussing the sequence as the large, I guess it's a carrier, comes crashing down on the planet, and that fight sequence that ends the whole first space battle. And I loved that sequence in its making of, because from a visual effects point of view, I was intrigued that the guys at ILM actually sort of mapped onto the geometry, as it were, of the ship that was coming down, things like steel wool kind of burning and stuff. And just like, if you actually look at the shots and break them down, there's a 2D flame saber kind of treatment that was done to them that is so, in one sense, simple. I mean, it wasn't simple, obviously, it was complicated, but it was, you know, it's so accessible that I was like, oh, I could actually do something like that. That was a great way to go. And they just incorporated a lot of great elements and a lot of really good cinematography. And I found that sequence culminating in the sort of crash landing to be a great kickoff to that third and final film. Did you enjoy that battle as much as I did?
I did. The previews for that was done by Chris Edwards and his team when they're up at Lucasfilm, and they've now become the Third Floor.
Third Floor, yeah. And in Los Angeles, and a great group of people.
Absolutely. Really nice guys. It's weird. The previous teams from Star Wars have a habit of sticking together and going off and forming their own company, because the previous team from Episode 2 went off to form Halon, one of the other preeminent previous houses here in L.A.
And also Zach, right? Is it Zach?
Yeah, Zach and Brad Alexander. And I find it amusing how much, you know, how many other companies have spawned off of Star Wars and its properties,
including Band from the Ranch.
Hey, oh, let's not go there. One of the funniest stories in the entire history of visual effects, but I don't think it would be polite to go into it now.
I think the name does say it all. But did you see any of the Spielberg drawings that he did for the previous team? Napkin drawings. I heard a talk that they gave, and saw a talk that they gave. They showed some Spielberg sketches. Now, Spielberg is not known for his drawing skills, and this was completely validated by these squiggles. But what's interesting about them is that they were almost stick characters, except for he kind of came up with a shorthand for a droid or a shorthand for a character, and then was consistent with it, right? So it was almost like an encrypted piece of I can't even say it, hieroglyphics, because when you understood the code, okay, that character is a droid because that's the three lines that means droid. There was actually quite a lot of correlation between what he drew and what actually ended up with, but it was very funny to look at.
You know, I think a lot of directors kind of do these really, really long shots just to prove they can, but I think it really works because it takes you from the characters and boom into the big, huge battle, all in one big sweeping moment, and really involves you in it. The one problem I've always had with that sequence is when they destroyed the tower at the end, because, you know, there were probably people in that tower. Kind of getting back to the Clerks argument about Star Wars when they blow up the Death Star, and the fact that, you know, the Rebels really probably blew up a whole lot of construction workers who...
Well, but nobody cares about the henchmen, right? We learned that from Austin Powers.
But yes, yeah, it's a fantastic sequence. The thing I really like about the prequels is that for a lot of the set extensions that they did, they weren't digital. I mean, they were comped digital, but they were actual models.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know if they'd fall into the bigature category, or if they would still be considered a miniature. But I remember watching, I believe it was an Indiana Jones behind the scenes documentary, and, you know, Spielberg was out directing a scene, and George was visiting the set, you know, in his role as producer, and he showed some tests of, you know, a miniature at that time and doing it as a blue screen composite, and Spielberg gives him a look like, you're nuts, dude. Like, we're always going to need to put sets. So even, you know, 25, 30 years ago, you know, Lucas was imagining the day where he just had a blue screen and the actors, and you could fill in the set behind it, and it just took a long time before the quality of compositing and motion control and all those, you know, all the technical things came into place where he could do it, and it would all blend naturally. But I think having a physical thing always matters. Like you were saying with the steel wool on fire. There are so many, you know, I'll see visual effects artists, you know, laboring over doing a particle simulation of smoke drifting away slowly in the film, you know, slowly in the wind. And I'm just like, just go blow something up and film it and then comp it in. And it's so much easier. Yeah, you need to do complex simulations if you have characters going through it and it's a principal part of the action. But otherwise, you know, nature does it better, faster, and with a whole lot less render time.
Well, let's change gears for a second and discuss the other huge favorite of mine. One individual shot that just for me was a moment where I did that whole kind of, you know, yeah, right on kind of in the theater, here we go, cheering kind of thing. I mean, maybe not out loud, but, you know, certainly on the inside. And that was the shot when Yoda flicks back his cape to start the beginning of the Yoda fight, the lightsaber fight. And I'm just wondering, that sequence, which was a turning point in Attack of the Clones, of course, that for me was a real point at which we'd really arrived at a digital character on screen that I was completely buying as a principal character. And the work that was done by Rob Coleman as the animation director on that, I thought was magnificent. I'm really interested in your opinion because I know some people are split on that fight sequence. Obviously, Yoda bounces around like a Tasmanian devil, and for some people that doesn't work. For me, that it did work. I loved that. What about you? Was that a good sort of prequel moment for you or not?
It was not. I fall into the category of people who did not like that particular fight. I like the shot where he goes, you know, the menace and emotion on his face when he, you know, reveals his lightsaber and goes to pull it out is great. But from the moment he launches forward and starts with the flippy, I did not like that one bit whatsoever. Mentally, you know, I realize it's Star Wars and you can't really bring a whole lot of logic into it, but Yoda is supposed to be something like, you know, 950 years old by the time Empire rolls around, which is only 25 years after Episode 2. So, you know, if he's 950 and he's decrepit and dying, but 925, he's a spry little flippy green guy, the maths don't just add up. I would have bought if he was like 700 or 600, but you know, if he's reaching the end of his lifespan, I just didn't get that. But the quality of the animation, fantastic, and they were just giving the director what he asked for, so you can't fault that, you know, that decision making process on the effects team. But the actual what was actually being done, I didn't really care for.
Okay, well, let's walk it backwards then, because the other huge controversial piece of character animation, without a doubt, is Episode 1, Jar Jar Binks. Whether it's the voice that was used, the overtones of some kind of African-American slur, or the fact that his knee was artificially high on the thigh bone, causing the walk cycle to look odd. Jar Jar was certainly a character that produced an enormous reaction. What's your position on that?
Again, I have to go with, I'm not a fan of the character, but technically an absolutely stunning achievement. You know, that predates Gollum. That predates pretty much any. I think the only two attempts of putting a digital character really, really, really into a film and interacting with actors before that would be Casper and Dragonheart. But both of those are not meant to, you know, a dragon you can get away with a whole lot, and Casper you can get away with a whole lot, but and still have it buy as plausible. But this is something that's supposed to be as real as a person in the suit. And do they reach that bar? Maybe, maybe not. But for the most part, it really, really works as a character integrated into the scene. But I think Jar Jar is a big reminder to a lot of Star Wars fans in my age group that Star Wars is for kids.
Interesting point you bring that up, because that's where I was going to go with it. Yeah. In fact, he's a character that is actually popular amongst the 7-year-old to 12-year-olds and not popular amongst the fans that grew up with Star Wars and are now re-experiencing it with their kids. And you have to ask, if the brief was to appeal to those kids and he succeeded, are we just kind of annoyed that it that the prequels didn't just aim at an older demographic? I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that I completely agree with you in terms of the technical success of the piece. I think Jar Jar technically worked really well. I found the voice really annoying. I mean, it very much grated on me. And yet, you know, as you say, like it was a character that was aimed at kids and, you know, it's like the comic relief sidekicky kind of character thing. I didn't play it. I know that some people edited the entire film to remove Jar Jar Binks and reckon that it was a better film for it. Did it wreck Ep 1 for you? I mean, what was your reaction on Ep 1? Were you, when you came out of Ep 1, having waited so many years for it, like so many of us did, what was your reaction? How prominently did he feature in your thinking?
I have a slightly skewed view when it comes to my memories of Episode 1. I was actually working within the Lucas Empire at the time. In the video game area, and when I saw Episode 1, I was seated 4 rows in front of George Lucas at the Lucasfilm screening at the Coronet in San Francisco. So as a bona fide Star Wars geek, it was, you know, let's just say I couldn't really watch the film objectively at the time. I remember seeing it a few days later when it came out in the theater with some friends on opening night, and you know, walking out and being able to look at it slightly differently. But by that time, I had been able to process the film a little bit more, and I was watching for other things. And there's a lot of a whole lot of good quality content that I believe is executed very, very badly in that movie as a storytelling element.
Now, when you say executed badly, but what do you mean by executed badly? You mean that the visual effects weren't up to it, or you mean the cinematography?
No, I meant the actual. It's like if you have a really great joke, but somebody who doesn't know how to tell it well, it's not funny. The story points that were in Episode 1 were actually really good. You know, you had this out of the way world, and you're positioning, the other dominant power in the Star Wars galaxy with the whole trade alliance to get into conflict with the Republic and weaken them, and arrange for a way for the senator that's going to become the chancellor, that's going to become the emperor, to get into a position of power, and all the political manipulations, you know, that are going on. It's all really quality kind of political thrillerish stuff, but it was executed in the framework of a kid's story. So you had to do a lot of what we call shoe leather, you know, a lot of walking from here to there and talking and explaining to the audience what it is you're doing and why you're doing it.
Well, how do you respond to the criticism that the first Star Wars film was about rebellion, dealing with your father and chicks, and the last films, which were being told by the same director, albeit much older in his life, was basically about taxation and retirement?
I think that's to a large extent that can be a valid argument, you know, the George Lucas who made the prequels. It's not the George Lucas who made the original trilogy. To that actual matter, the George Lucas who made Return of the Jedi is not the George Lucas who made A New Hope. You know, he became a father. He was going through a divorce at the time. And all these outside factors are always going to influence who you know, the type of art you create. So, yeah, there's...
I mean, they should be personal stories, right? Because this is the, let's face it, the largest set of indie films ever made. I mean, after the deal with Fox on one, going into two and three, he really carved his own turf, and that gave him a degree of autonomy at a budgetary level unimagined by most independent filmmakers. And, you know, I mean, you shouldn't have any reason why these films aren't personal stories.
Exactly. And not only are they indie films, which I realize a lot of people have a kind of hard time looking at them as such, but they really are. But Episode One is the first film, you know, like the first big budget, huge sci-fi film that I can ever think of that they knew before they put a single person in front of a lens that they are going to get to make two other sequels to. That you could really tell the first part of a bigger story. And you've had other directors who had planned to do that, such as...
well, with Dune.
Yeah, or Unbreakable, for instance, from M. Night Shyamalan, where, you know, the first movie is set up and the other two start to pay it off, and if the other two don't get made, it doesn't really work out well. You know, Peter Jackson was able to do that.
Yeah, I think Lord of the Rings could do it. Yeah, I think Unbreakable... I actually think Unbreakable works fine as a single film. I think what you're saying is absolutely true. I mean, you saw that in Lord of the Rings, right? Like, he just knew where he could go with it because he was making the three. But look, I think the thing about the... I want to sort of swing back to the visual effects for a second. I think the thing about the three films, and I'm going to also discuss, obviously, the original two sequels, but those three films that came out as the Eps 1, 2, and 3 had, obviously, an enormous weight of... expectation, enormous weight of just, you know, anything that they do at some point was going to get criticized. And yet...
Something I have some experience with now.
Absolutely. But I've got to say, I think ILM delivered. I think, you know, at a visual effects point of view, I'm not looking at those films. Now, the criticism of Jar Jar, I should quote from something that Rob Collins said, which is, if you actually design a character like Jar Jar and actually give him the proportions that that character did and you create an absolutely perfect walk cycle, that's how the character's going to walk, right? You can't lift up an overly long leg with a high knee and not have him walk kind of funny, because that's just the mechanics of how it would happen. And almost no creatures are anatomically made that way. But hey, it's a Star Wars universe. But look at not so much Jar Jar as an individual, but the battle sequence at the end of Ep 1, which was just a magnificent... That first time we saw the masses of robotic versus... God, I've forgotten the name of the Jar Jar species now. Getting drummed out of the Star Wars fan club. But, you know what I mean? Like that ground plane, which I used to think of as being on the Windows hills of green. I just thought that was terrific. I thought it was out in the bright sun. It was working really well. The comps looked good. And they were all digital characters from both sides, be them droids or be them Jar Jar's comrades, whose name escapes me. They all sat in there really, really well, and then was cutting back to the space battle and cutting back to what was going on at the palace. I mean, so much of that was being digitally provided, and it was a massive set of intercuts. And you know what? I mean, it delivered for me. I just did not look at that stuff and technically find fault with it. I thought it was just magnificent. And as I say, run forward.
I think the sequence that stands out most to me in that movie, both as a just really great sequence and also on a technical level, is the pod race sequence. You know, especially the destruction of the pod racers when they're tumbling across, you know, an all digital desert floor. And I completely bought that as completely realistic. You know, there's absolutely no fault I can find with that. Even to this day.
So getting back to the space battle at the beginning of episode 6, which is where we kind of started, don't you think that still managed to top anything else that Star Wars had done? Don't you think that we actually saw over the 6 films them doing something that, you know, you would have said they'd already nailed? They just tended to top it and top it and top it. I mean, it just consistently improved upon itself. I mean, I just find that the only way to go was to introduce, like as Battlestar Galactica did, like a manual kind of camera that had sort of obvious camera defects, because I've not seen anybody else really knock it out of the ballpark in producing both realistic, well, to want, you know, realistic in that world, I guess believable, but also just stuff that I could follow. Like I can actually follow those battles. They're not just a blur on the screen. They actually kind of make sense, and I can get a sense of being on the edge of my seat. Because honestly, in some of the other areas that some of the other action films have gone in, they've got to a point where they're just pushed and pushed and pushed on a fight sequence until I can't tell what's going on anymore, and I just give up, and I just wait till it's over, and I know my hero will still be standing because we're still that early in the film that he couldn't have died. But that's not like that. Even up to Ep 6, I'm still hanging in there and actually following the logic, the geography, if you like, of a fight sequence in space. I think it's a really amazing job that they've come up with.
Well, I mean, they pay attention to cinematic language 101, you know, screen direction, you know, framing and all that kind of stuff. So you always have a sense of geography, which in space is, you know, kind of a weird term to think of. But you always know where the heroes are coming from and where the villains are and how they're progressing towards said villains. And just by doing those simple things and not having 19 cuts every 5 frames, you are able to really seat yourself in the action and follow along with it, and that makes it a lot more thrilling than just throwing a lot of bright colors and loud noises at the audience. So I think it's really, really effective, really well choreographed, and really well thought out.
Well, let's jump back then, because I've deliberately working our way backwards. We've sort of talked a bit about the Eps 1, 2, and 3. Let's talk about Eps 5 and 6. For me, to the day I die, Empire is going to be my Star Wars that I just love to death. I mean, that was the film that I almost screamed out loud at the end of, because I was young, it finished, and I could not imagine living in a universe that I had to wait a year or two before the next film came out to work out what the heck went, you know, came. I've never, to this day, ever felt such a, oh my God, how can we possibly wait to find out what happens next? Was that the same for you? Is Empire your favorite of the remaining 5 since Ep 1 has been already covered? Or rather, Ep 3, Ep 4, sorry, has been covered?
Yeah, of all 6, I have a deep emotional attachment to the first, to A New Hope, but Empire is, I think, the best of all the 6. It's the one I enjoy rewatching over and over and over again. I think it's just a fantastic movie. It has one of the, okay, spoiler alert, Darth Vader is Luke's dad. You know, it has one of the biggest reveals in cinematic history. I still remember going, "Oh no way!" When that happened, you know, when that information was revealed, it kind of like rocked your world to the foundation.
It rocked it so much, and you were desperately thinking, "Is this a trick? Is that true? Is it not?" But you know what? It wasn't so much of a bizarre thing that they jumped the shark. For me, I didn't go, well, that's it. I've had it with Star Wars. That's just preposterous. That's ridiculous. I'm not going there. Was that for you?
It was very much the same thing. Interesting little nerd tidbit. What was actually said on set at the day is, you know, because they, you know, George didn't want to give that away or have the possibility of it leaking out. Which even back then was a concern. I can't even imagine, you know, in nowadays with the internet, how you can keep anything like that secret. But, you know, what he said is, you know, Obi-Wan lied to you. I didn't kill your father. He did. You know, Obi-Wan did. And that was like the big reveal. But it was all a lie, of course. That's just what David Prowse said on the day. But I mean, it was such a, you know, like, you know, you had the exact same reaction as Luke did. It's like, no, That's impossible. And then you want to throw yourself off a cliff because, you know, here's the big, huge bad guy, and he can't possibly be the good guy's dad. You know, that's just not the way things are. If you're a good guy, then your dad is a good guy, and that's just how it is. And
and you know what? For me, in episodes 5 and 6, at visual effects terms, it also hit a high point with a snow battle that at the time was the compositor's worst nightmare, right? Having a snow battle where you couldn't hide things in the darks. I mean, we know today that some of those comps were in fact appallingly bad in the sense that they had to sort of mix vertical uprights of the shots from inside the spaceship. Like they'd have, you know, struts and stuff. They actually had to mix those 50% because they didn't want to have black lines and stuff. And of course, when they were digitally remastered, those were all fixed. But I never noticed that. I just thought that that was a breathtaking sequence, a snow battle, a battle with everything that would go on to become iconic. I thought, you know, if there was an expectation going into the second one, we all talk about the second one being darker and all that kind of stuff, but of 5 and 6, that battle in the snow was just a classic piece of riveting, you know, seat of your pants. It was a completely different environment, nothing we'd seen before. It was like they just opened a door to a whole new Star Wars environment. And I was like, well, yeah, of course there are snow planets. Why wouldn't there be? Did you love that as much as I?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, who can forget, you know, Phil Tippett's iconic, you know, the AT-AT Walker animation and the whole way that, you know, you had, especially looking at it from a visual effects standpoint, you had, you know, multiple shots in a row that are just pure visual effects from top to bottom. It's just, you know, in the middle of this movie with live actors, you have stop motion, and in no way does it feel like a little tiny 18-inch high
it doesn't,
you know,
no.
Toy. It feels like this massive walking building.
Now, did they do go motion on that sequence?
I believe it was both go motion and stop motion, depending on what was needed. I believe go motion was used on the Tauntauns and such, but I believe the AT-ATs were actual pure stop motion.
As you should probably explain what go motion is for those that don't know, because of course, not like a lot of stop motion is used today.
Right. Go motion was a technique that was developed, and you know, I'm pretty sure somebody slapped themselves on the forehead and said, "But of course." It was developed by Phil Tippett and Dennis Muren with the idea that if a shutter is open for X amount of time in general, for half the amount of 1/48th of a second, and something's moving at a given speed, it's going to be smeared, aka motion blurred. And that stop motion takes a perfectly still photograph. And, you know, it's very easy to see nowadays. Just set your renderer to not use motion blur. That's what stop motion looks like. And set your scene to render with motion blur. And that's what go motion is, or looks like. Because what they would do is, you know, they would set the new keyframe, and a computer would actually, you know, figure out what the motion need to be. And when the shutter on the camera was open, it would move that amount so that it had a proper amount of smear and give a startling amount of realism to the stop motion animation that was being done by Phil Tippett and his crew.
The thing we have to remember is that this is not, and we've talked about ILM, this is really the birth of ILM, because ILM was not formed, as maybe some people think, for Star Wars Episode One. A team came together that worked on Star Wars Episode One. The team reformed for its sequel, and it was that was the basis of ILM. And it's just astounding when you look at the blockbusters that are delivered this summer by ILM. And of course, I was lucky enough to hear several of them given as talks at SIDGRAPH, just, you know, how much that company has been at the center of what we're talking about. But But not only that, these techniques, like that one you're just describing there, David, I mean, this is all literally invented there. This is not using the best techniques of the day. These were the guys that were writing the textbooks literally as they went along. And I can't imagine how daunting to do all that in a pre-computer era. I mean, this is, as we discussed, we're talking about episode one, just the days of optical printers and the most rudimentary motion control rigs. It's astounding.
Yeah, it was an era where, you know, you didn't, you know, I think a lot of people can get by in the visual effects world today, you know, going out and buying a book, you know, how to use Maya 101, and can fake their way into a job in the industry. Well, not under current economic conditions, but generally you could. And back then you actually had to not only know how to do this stuff, but you had to have a real problem-solving mentality. And it was a real mixture of you're a filmmaker, you're an engineer, you're you know, a down-and-dirty mechanic who can figure this stuff out. And you had to be a real Renaissance jack of all trades type person, and you just don't really encounter that often in the digital era, because to a large extent it's not needed.
Well, so many of these guys came from camera department, didn't they? I mean, really the only place that was doing special effects was camera department. You know, it was effects in camera. Obviously there were matte paintings and stuff, glass paintings as it were, which were still used by these guys in these first sequels. But really, that training in camera, I think, spoke volumes to how well the nucleus that formed to become ILM really provided. And I think I'm right in saying even people like John Knowles and stuff actually joined up with that sort of camera department, maybe motion control building kind of background. It was pretty important, I think, to having that kind of sensibility. That's what really sort of set the bar, that real photographic approach.
Yeah, I have a simple policy even to this day where I don't really trust a visual effects artist who doesn't own a DSLR.
It's the number one thing you can do, I reckon, to improve if you're early in visual effects, is just get a DSLR and just take a lot of photographs, really understand what's working. And you know what? Don't just stick with the original default lens you bought with the package. You know, actually get some primes, get a few different lenses, and just learn what lenses. I couldn't agree with you more, David. That's absolutely pivotal.
Actually, the other thing that it's fun to do, although I'm sure some people will think it's just an evil thing to do, is go to a pawn shop and find some cheap broken down lens. Doesn't even have to be for your camera, and take it apart. And just, you know, see how a lens works, you know, understand how it works. Go buy an old film back, like that used old film that you can maybe pick up for $80. Take it apart. Understand how a camera works, because other than the fact of it having, you know, a piece of plastic covered with chemicals passing by, it's now a CCD. To a large extent, cameras work very, very similarly.
You'll be amused to know this, but tomorrow we're actually going to be shooting Super 8. And tomorrow at sunset, we'd figured we'd go old school. Actually, we bought some Super 8 cameras on eBay, and we're just, for the fun of it, just going to actually roll some film Super 8 style. And in fact, these are absurdly good cameras for the ridiculously small amount of money we paid for them on eBay. And we're actually going to be shooting Super 8 off Segways, but nevertheless, we're actually going and shooting some Super 8. I think you might get a kick out of that.
What you should do is, because Super 8s are generally pretty thin, strap them together and film Super 8 in stereo. that'll make me really happy.
Yeah, sure, because the alignment and working out really good calibration is not going to be a problem at all, he said sarcastically.
Yeah, not at all. I'm sure you can sync them together somehow. I've had the really great pleasure over the course of my professional career of meeting a lot of the guys who were, and even working with some of the guys who were instrumental in this. I worked with Ken Ralston. I've had more than a couple of encounters with Dennis Muren over the years, including he was on my tug of war team one year at the Skywalker picnic.
Isn't Dennis Muren like the nicest guy? Like, I can't honestly think, put my hand on my heart, I can't think of a single one of those guys that isn't a genuinely nice guy and also really generous with their time to the community.
They're incredibly generous with their time. They're incredibly humble. Especially considering the impact that they've had on the industry, on people working in it. They are the Leviathans of our industry. In animation, there's that, the nine old men from Disney. and all of these guys, Dykstra, Ralston, Muren, et cetera, are all the people you go and you look back, and if you're lucky enough to work with one of them, you can always count on being able to turn to them and ask their advice, and they're going to be able to give you an answer that you would probably have never thought of because you're so used to thinking in one way, whereas they're used to thinking about the problem, not the tool that's in front of them. And you know, like I said, I consider myself very, very lucky for having met and just gotten to hear old war stories from them. And
not that we should paint them all as being that old, right? Because, I mean, people like Rob Coleman's now on Happy Feet 2, obviously John Knoll's still at ILM. Like, it's not like they've all retired and closed up shop or anything.
No, absolutely not. But, I think – and obviously I don't want to get all morose or anything like that. But at some point – you know, we're going to not have – we're only going to be surrounded by people who've only been working in the digital realm. And that'll be a pretty sad day. So hopefully the idea of actually going out and building something will always be around.
So let's sum up what we've been talking about. And I'm going to get you to sort of name some bits. So We've got five apps to choose from. We're limiting it to that. We're avoiding the games and some of the other spin-off stuff. Well, I've been quick to point out a few of the things that really appeal to me. What about, are there some real highlights for you professionally from apps 2 through to 6? In terms of VFX, not in terms of story or...
Yeah, there's one shot that I just... It's my absolute favorite shot in all of Star Wars. It's from Return of the Jedi, and it has the Millennium Falcon kind of banking left and right, going through the whole armada of rebel ships just as they're about to take off for light speed to go take on the second Death Star. And it's just an amazing, amazing shot. Like, just as a cinematic shot, it's awesome. But when you realize the technicality of the choreography that had to go into actually doing that with a motion control camera and all the layers of composite that had to go in there, it's insane, and it works perfectly, flawlessly. And other than that and the AT-ATs, I think are just absolutely fantastic. They're one of my favorite things in all of Star Wars.
Yeah, I must agree with you there. Though I will say this, that the as soppy and as obvious a thing as it is, the excellence of the execution of R2-D2 and C-3PO in all their different guises, both digital and half-built digital and all that kind of stuff, still, I just think, just really defined an entire type of character on screen for me. And to this day, we've mentioned it before in the past, but if you guys have ever get a chance to see Under the Dome, which is a mockumentary about R2-D2 and his the way he performs on screen and the way he pulls chicks and stuff off camera, it's one of the funniest authorized Lucasfilm, but sort of it kind of grew, I think, to something more than they expected it to be. I think it's on the web. It was certainly on the web, but it's called Under the Dome. And yeah, those guys for me, R2-D2 and 3CPO, are so well executed in every guise. And looking back today, there's no way I do them differently. There's nothing about those characters that I think isn't working. And in fact, the limitations that they have work incredibly well. I'm just talking now about physicality and the rendering of them and stuff. I'm even willing to go with the gaming sequence in the factory when I say that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that was the one that was like, I think it was added at the last minute, like well after principal photography was done, and that's when it was revealed that R2 can fly, which was okay.
It's a shame he hadn't used it before then, but yes.
Actually, I'm kind of happy you brought that up, because I thought what was really interesting about that sequence and that shot is, you know, for episode one, you had most of ILM was working on SGIs running, you know, to some of our younger members who are used to a high-end visual effects computer costing $6,000 or $7,000 and a high-end piece of visual effects software costing $3,000. I believe, you know, we had the indie, but, you know, the average desktop SGI at the time was probably about $30,000 to $80,000 hardware, depending on how much you were investing in the iron. And I believe Power Animator and Softimage each cost about $60,000 a license at the time.
Hey, let's not forget about Flame, which is the basis of Saber, which was kicking it on an Onyx at about $1 million. I mean,
exactly.
Software and hardware combined.
So, you know, you had a lot of infrastructure and cost going into it. And John Knoll was running a unit at ILM called the Rebel Unit, or the Rebel Mac Unit, depending on how you want to hear it. And I believe that shot of R2-D2 was done completely in Lightwave. You know, so it was proved, you know, they were proving at the time that you could do feature film level effects that could intercut with this, you know, $1 million hardware software combination on a piece of hardware and software that cost under $10,000. And that was right around the time where the big paradigm shift to desktop class workstations was really underway. So, you know, even on that level, they were really cutting edge.
Well, of course, Alex Lindsay worked on the Rebel Mac unit and worked on the
and Stu Mashwitz.
And at one, yeah. So a lot of good people. Well, we've run out of time, as we knew, of course, we would, given the scope of this particular ep.
I would like to say before we go, because we talked a lot about the analog versus digital thing over the two Star Wars shows. And by the way, thanks to all the people who pointed out that the original Star Wars are available on DVD. They came out in a box set where you had to rebuy the prequels. That's how I missed them. So thank you, everyone, to the many, 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 many people who messaged me on Twitter.
The other thing we've completely skipped, and I don't know how I allowed this to happen, is in all this discussion about the visual effects, we really should flag the fact that the cinematography was as equally revolutionary in the Epps, you know, the sequels, as it were, the more recent ones, because, of course, of the advent of digital capture and using the F900s and actually shooting with the panavised versions of those cameras. And for the first time, and we don't even think about it today in terms of shooting on Red or Genesis or F23, F35, but those Sony cameras, I mean, shooting EP2 digitally was a huge breakthrough at the time that it happened.
No, absolutely. And I remember... you know, at the time, the Sony engineers came with this digital cinema camera, and they're like, yes, it captures at 60 frames per second. And, you know, it took someone like George Lucas going, no, 24 frames per second. And they're like, well, 60's more. More is better. And you know, only someone with the, you know, there's very few directors that could go to a multinational corporation like Sony and say, don't do it like you want to. Do it how it's right.
You know, we're having that same debate today about the 5D Mark II, aren't we?
Absolutely. You know, it's a problem that we have all the time in software, where you have, you know, the people who are programming the software aren't necessarily using the software. I remember way back when on FX Guide TV, you had an interview with Scott Squires where he was talking about that very thing. And that's why Commotion was such a wonderful piece of software, you know, because it was being programmed by someone who actually used it. So, you know, it required somebody who had the who was there during the formation of a digital cinema camera to say, no, if you're a cinema camera, you run at 24 FPS. If you want to run at other FPS, we're not going to stop you. but you better run at 24 FPS.
You know, we haven't mentioned Scott Squire's contribution, but he is an enormous contributor to the whole Star Wars visual effects as one of the... there were actually, what, three supervisors and one animation director on Ep 1. And, yeah, it was a remiss of us not to mention him. And you know what? I mean, I totally agree with you. That whole 24p thing. But not only that, I think that there was... for me anyway, a kind of an obvious quality difference, because if we look at Ep 1, there was a few shots snuck in on digital cinematography almost like as a test when it was still at 30, and those shots really stood out to me. I could actually tell quite easily.
Oh, me too.
And then when they went to Ep 2, of course, I was dreading the whole film would look like that, and it didn't. I thought it looked good, and they weren't even able to use, you know, the full sensor, because of course they were having to crop in for the aspect ratio that they wanted. But, you know, what a pioneering amount of work, because clearly you needed at that stage a company like ILM to deal with all of the issues that were the learning curves that, of course, has now facilitated us doing the digital cinematography that we do today with vastly more ease. So, yeah.
I remember they had pretty intense problems pulling mats on the digital cinematography, because a lot of the tricks they use, you know, because film grain is a lot more forgiving. To some extent that you can get
by. Well, it was HD cam as well, and HD cam has so much more compression than even SR HD that we use today.
Right.
You know, it was so hard work.
Yeah, it's just like you were doing a proven technology in the terms of green and blue screen, but by mixing in a whole different piece of new technology, all the tricks and gags and your whole workflow kind of got thrown out the window, and they all had to relearn it very, very quickly.
Well, and what it added to those, you know, huge miniatures as well, because you have to pump so much light in to get the depth of field. It wasn't funny.
Right.
So, yeah, it's like a whole range of stuff. But look, we really are out of time, so we're going to have to wrap it up. I want to say thank you so much, David, for doing this. Maybe you could give a shout-out to our producer and team behind the scenes.
Absolutely. Before I do it, because I want to finish my thought, there are many, 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 many books on Star Wars and the making of Star Wars and all that kind of stuff. But the one that I think everyone would be remiss to not take a look at is this wonderful book called Sculpting a Galaxy. And it has these beautiful museum quality photographs and printing of the models that were built for all the Star Wars films. And the craftsmanship and attention to detail and love that went into these things is really needs to be seen to be appreciated. So I just want to suggest everyone pick that book up. The VFX Show is a joint production of Pixacore and FX Guide. Our producer is Kristen Martin, and our researcher is Lori Apthorpe. So thank you very much, guys. You guys do a whole bunch of work behind the scenes. That's about it.
Yeah, and we were hoping to have perhaps Mark with us tonight, but Mark wasn't able to make it. But hopefully we'll have Mark Christensen on very soon. We miss not having Mark on. And, of course, John and some of the other guys are also kind of coming back, though. John is traveling. Matt is busy in Sydney. You know, the extended family here at VFX Show all really appreciate your contributions, both on Twitter and just, you know, emails that you send in. So please keep those coming, because we really do like getting feedback from you guys. And the show's been growing, especially this last year. So we really thank you for that. Well, that's it for this week. Please check out some of the back throws. We've got some other really great shows coming up. Things will get back to normal a bit as we all return to our kind of native homes, and we can schedule things a little more easy. And I certainly will be better not being quite so sick as I've been for this last week or so. Traveling and being sick, not a good look. But David, thank you so much for being on today.
Oh, thank you very much, Mike. Always a pleasure talking with you.
And we'll catch you guys next time. Thanks so much. Bye.